Hello, welcome to Film Interrupted. My name is Jack.
My name is Martin.
My name is Nick.
How you doing, first of all?
That was very natural.
I've been practicing. You said I'm trying to be natural. Customer services.
You're better than I am.
Yeah, very well.
I'm too sarcastic to my customers.
I know.
Yeah.
But it's the Scottish way. It's different over here. It's one of the biggest differences between Scotland and America is sarcasm's taken as something really aggressive, where it's really friendly in Scotland.
Yeah. I had a drunk old woman yesterday, either drunk or, you know, on some heavy medication, and she'd been eating like smoked salmon and like salmon mousse, like kind of rolls, just out of a pack she'd like picked up in the shop and torn open, and she like brought them back to me, and she's like, "These are too salt." Like, too salt? Too salt! And I'll have half a rotisserie chicken. And I was just like kind of taken aback. So like, "You want a rotisserie chicken? Half a rotisserie chicken. Okay, I'll give you half a rotisserie chicken." She was just, I don't know, must have been either just like having a grand old time, having a few drinks, but no.
What does she look like?
About 60-ish, blonde hair, a kind of cream, like, anorak thing. You wouldn't expect her to be, like, you know, smacked out of her nut or anything,
wow.
You know? But yeah, I got our security guard Badmos to follow her about. And,
really? Yeah. Did anything else occur?
Big fight.
Okay.
Badmos not fuck out of her.
Yeah, I mean, it is surprising because, in the kind of job that you're in, you're sort of expected to be at the behest of the customers, particularly with the establishment that you work for.
Perpetually pleasant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you maintain that?
Yeah,
nowhere near.
Yeah, but there's a... Go on, Jack.
I do a pretty good job, but you're really expected to have the perma smile in America. It's much different from in the UK. You can be a bit cheeky in the UK and get away with it, and it's just part of the dialogue over there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really pull that shit off in America, and I sometimes miss it. It's always on the tip of my tongue, like, right.
I actually adapt quite well to those sort of social environments where I have to be very polite. It's like there's almost a security blanket aspect to it where, like, I can assure myself that at least I'm doing my absolute best in this situation.
I think when someone actually tries to become really offensive, then you just, like, it's kind of automatic to go into the, you know, "I'm sorry you feel that way, sir."
And it's a wonderful shaming tactic, like, to be as polite and as nice to someone as you can be when they're being a total arsehole, and then they walk away going, "Oh, I need to rethink my life." And that's when I bring out the Bible. Like, "Come here, mate."
I've never been very good at it until I got to the US, but you're right, it's something you kind of have to do because you can't be, "Listen, mate, just fuck off." You can't do that here. Like, even in a bar job, if you're doing that there, you just couldn't do it. I've seen people in bars being arseholes, and they treat them totally different than, like, you know, a barman would in the UK. But I mean, I've had someone just, like, call me a bastard before working in my job, which is ridiculous. It's like, I didn't do anything. I just, you know, I don't even want to contextualize the situation. It was absurd, and my response was, "Oh, that wasn't a very nice thing to say, was it? Well," I just had to, like, take that approach to it, where, and it is very kind of primary school teacher, you know, primary school student scenario, where you automatically get the high ground by doing that. But yeah, that's weird. But anyway, enough about the actual day jobs. Have you been watching anything outside the films we're discussing today?
Went into the first episode of Boardwalk Empire of the fourth season. It was slightly underwhelming, but, you know, again, it's just setting out the kind of, you know, the character of, you know, who's going to be, you know, moving into the, you know, the new season, and, you know, setting up story strands and so on. So it was all a bit kind of, you know, here's an introduction to what we're going to consider over the next year, rather than like, "Oh, wow, this is really good and dramatic." So, yeah, I'll look forward to the season, but as a first episode, it was a bit dry.
Yeah.
Is Michael Shannon still part of that? I've never watched it.
He didn't feature at all in this episode, but I expect he will turn up I think he's currently loitering somewhere in Chicago. So I'm assuming when, you know, Al Capone's storyline gets, you know, fleshed out, there'll be some kind of, you know, meeting up.
It's really weird that we actors kind of fill their time between TV and movies now. It's just sort of like testament to how far TV's come,
mm-hmm.
as being this junky thing. I saw like Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson are the two leads of a HBO TV show. Woody Harrelson's got, you know, a respectable career, takes some good movies, but Matthew McConaughey, he's just gone like, his career just took off in a huge way. He's been cast in really big things, you know, he's been recognised for awards and stuff, and he took a TV show. And if you say that sentence out loud at any point in the current period, that, you know, he just got a lead in a sci-fi epic, and he just took a TV show, it wouldn't make any sense. But we're kind of in a time just now where the writing quality is so good, and, you know, the budget's there for TV to be good, that you can have actors do both at the same time. You know, they've got like a seasonal job almost.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was hearing about certain actors in the Game of Thrones series have been, you know, lost because it's such a, like, you know, expansive story with so many bit part characters to come in. There are people that, you know, have kind of, you know, basically said, look, I need to have other jobs, and, you know, your schedule of, you know, me waiting for, you know, 3 years to come back and be, you know, the Mountain, that doesn't really work for me, because they've lost one of the Cleganes, basically the big brother, not the main character, but, you know, the other one, and I noticed that there's another character, what's his name, it's Beric Dondarrion. Because he featured quite heavily in the last season. He's the kind of leader of the sort of band of rebels.
Oh, did you cast him?
Yeah, he's a completely different person.
Oh, that's a shame. I like that.
I haven't like checked on IMDb to, like, you know, verify this, but it's like, there's no way that's the same guy.
Yeah. That's what bothers me about TV. I heard Kevin Spacey talking recently, I think it was the Edinburgh Television Festival, and he's saying that because of the way the model changes just now, you make things in one fell swoop, you don't try and piecemeal it out across broadcast TV. And he's referring to House of Cards, which went out on Netflix, that people will consume it wholemeal, but you can also produce it wholemeal. You don't have to film it episode by episode, week by week, which completely undermines any kind of, well, a lot of things. It makes it really inefficient to film, first of all. And he was claiming there'll be no difference between TV and film in the near future. And I think there's, like, a lot of points to that, but, and I've talked about my wife a lot too recently, that, and this is where just I'm clearly an advocate of the auteur theory, that there's no, I think that there isn't enough single sense of authorship to carry through TV shows to justify the claim that Kevin Spacey's making, that there's going to be no difference. Something like Kimmy's been watching something called, I think is it Above the Lake?
Top of the Lake.
It's like a Jane Campion TV show. It's essentially just a 6-hour film. And that's been constructed in that way. But Kevin Spacey arguing for House of Cards being just like a film is completely undermined for me, because it didn't have a single sense of authorship. Watched the first two episodes directed by David Fincher, and it was amazing. It was incredibly stylistic and had a great tone. And in the third episode, it changed completely. Different scriptwriter, different director, and it just didn't even feel like the same show for me. So,
but to a certain extent, isn't that what television offers that cinema doesn't? Like, it does offer this kind of fractured, different perspectives on the material as it, you know, as it progresses. I mean, that's, you know, you hear about, you know, guys from television moving into cinema, and that their episodes are always singled out as reasons why, you know, they've done that. But that's kind of what, well, for me anyway, although television has a Bible, the fact that it's, you know, separated between, you know, different people, it's kind of one of its defining qualities.
Well, I think that's changing. I think that's what I'm talking about, and that I think people are moving not from TV into cinema, but from cinema into TV. Like, Glenn Close has got a bloody TV show. You know, the scripts are better there. It's more adult. You get more world building, and people are jealous of what you can do in the course of the time you're given to do it in television.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, it's, everyone's talking about it, and it's true that television has really surpassed cinema and just the scope of what it can realise.
See, I'm not sure. Like, I've been watching, like, for the first time I've kind of dipped in back into television, and I've done that with The Shield. Did you guys watch The Shield at
yes,
all?
Yes, you know.
I'm not like, a big advocate, yeah.
I'm not a big fan of it, although I'm on season 5, and I've been watching it for, like, 3 weeks, so I'll tell you.
This is rubbish. Let's get the next one.
And that is true, because it is so easy for me to watch and just burn my way through it, but I still don't think I'm in love with it. Like, I think for me, I do see a lot of the... There's a lot of things where... Maybe I'm walking in from the perspective of, you know, this sort of... I feel like I've got a chip on my shoulder because everyone says that television's better than cinema just now. Mm. And so when I sit down to watch it, I'm like, right, go on. Impress me. And I just... Yeah, I'm not in love with the show by any means. I think
but
it's,
you've pursued it for what, like, you know... An entire, like, you know, week's worth of viewing.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, the show is, like, how would you describe it? It's Vic Mackey, who's this, you know...
It's a rogue cop show.
Stop me if you've heard this before. He's a cop who doesn't...
Not an anti-hero.
Yeah. He doesn't quite play by the rules, but he's got his own internal rule book that he sticks to when he's dishing out his own brand of vigilante justice. And I mean, it's good. Like, I do like that character a lot, mm-hmm. even though I do think he becomes a little bit fudged as the show goes on. And I don't know if I really think... I think the show sets out a premise that it doesn't quite live up to. Like, have you seen the show, Jack?
It just gets kind of murkier and murkier, you know?
No, I dismissed it offhand based on, like, a single scene I saw, a sequence. So, like, I dismissed it really yeah. when I didn't have any right to. I'll admit that. But
it has... a ridiculous twist at the end of the first episode that is just completely bizarre shock tactic television, and then they spend at least what I've seen for the next 5 seasons going, why the fuck did we do that? Like, how can we possibly justify what we did in that episode?
Yeah, no, it made life very awkward for them.
Yeah, like, I mean, we made our point, you know, we got people on to episode 2, but, you know, Jesus Christ, we're going to have to explain this now.
Yeah, sustaining it and then, like It keeps going and going with, like, you know, more people being, like, you know, unforgivably slaughtered for, yeah. for, like, you know, very, like, very thin reasons.
I'm sure Jack, or our viewers, or our listeners rather, won't mind if I spill the beans on the end of the first episode of The Shield, but
sure,
there's, like, Vic Mackey, as I say, he's a sort of fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants sort of, you know, as Martin said, anti-hero police officer who, you know, take bribes as long as he can, you know, plant evidence as long as he can maintain the streets in some kind of order. The first episode's all about his commanding officer putting a mole into his team who's going to report on them and find out, you know, the extent to which, you know, their sort of depravity goes in terms of upholding the law. The episode one ends with a drug bust where they run into this dealer's home or whatever. They are the strike team, so they are the first men on the ground to go in with their guns blazing, and, you know, if the guys don't come willingly, they'll use hostile force. And it ends up, they do have to use hostile force against this drug dealer. They take him down, and then Vic Mackey, our main character, turns around to the mole who's been planted by his commanding officer and shoots him in the face, as, you know, because he's obviously become aware of the fact that this guy's here to bring down his team.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So now they've murdered a police officer in cold blood in that moment, and that's the way the episode ends. And that is an unthinkable act from Vic Mackey. You know, from the character that we come to know for the remaining, you know, I'm on, as I say, series 5. The character in season 5 is incapable of doing what he did in episode 1, and they're just now getting to realise that, right, we really need to address the fact that we've done this and work out some kind of sense that we can make of it.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I'm not. It's a show that I'm addicted to, but I don't think it's of particularly high quality.
I mean, it's just I don't know if I don't think I could agree with you that it's not of high quality. I mean, I think it's quite hard to like, though, because it's just lots of dislikable people. There's very little to root for, and a lot of the characterization is quite hackneyed and stereotyped. I mean, they paint in very broad strokes in The Shield. It's not a, you know, kind of like, you know, overall very finely nuanced.
It tends to get a reaction because of the scale of depravity. It won't try and find the depravity inherent in, you know, someone who's living outside the law. It will say, like, we've got a paedophile ring of, you know, 20 children who are being filmed having sex in these videos, and you think, okay, one's fine, you know, let's not just keep... It's like, it's this approach where something's worse if you click in the corner and drag it up to fill your whole screen of just horror.
Yeah, but no, I think it tends to kind of excel in, you know, just the sort of... the truthfulness of the kind of, like, the friendships between the characters that it builds and the, like, you know, the intense tensions that they create by just being such dreadful people.
Mm.
I think as a drama, it's quite funny. I think there's, you know,
there's intentionally or black humor.
Those first episodes aren't funny. Those first they are so not funny that it's ridiculous. Yeah.
No,
there's actually one bit where I remember thinking, "What the fuck am I watching?" When the strike team are sitting around a table, joking and joshing with each other, and oh, what's his name? Walter Goggins' character with the teeth.
Yeah, his name's completely gone out of my head.
In any event,
I've watched the entire thing.
He's like, knock knock. They're like joshing about. They're having fun. They're a bunch of lads. Knock knock. And they're like, who's there? He's like, strike team, Mr. Drug Dealer. And then they're like, ah, ha, 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 like high fiving. Like, what the
fuck? Yeah, I think to some extent it was kind of like they were all like, you know, playing a role within a role. We're really convinced that we're this, you know, like, you know, sort of, you know, hard charging, you know, gang of cops, but, you know, there's like, you know, oh, we're so sensitive underneath.
I think I would get more out of it if I did like genre television. You know, I like genre films, but I'm not really into genre telly. So like, they do sometimes have like freak of the week type episodes where it's, you know,
yes,
this one murder that's gone wrong and or this one crime that's occurred and they need to
his
get
name's
this
Shane.
Guy. Shane, that's
Shane.
His name. And but they'll like get him in the interrogation room and he has to break down and confess and he'll be like, yeah, I did it. And I don't regret it either, you know. When it's painful at moments when that happens. But again, if I had an appreciation for that type of storytelling through television, then I guess I would like it more. But just when I watch those, they just make me cringe when that happens.
But you still watch them all.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I will continue.
And yet
them.
You don't have an appreciation of genre television. you're ravenously consuming it.
Yeah,
I think you protest too much. I know.
We watched the they made a Hannibal TV show, Hannibal Lecter TV show, and I was deeply, deeply dubious about it until then that Mads Mikkelsen was playing Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, one of my friends has been going on and on about this at work.
It's very good. It's the most cinematic-looking show. It's beautiful. They spent a lot of money on it. And the general structure is good. But here's my one grievance. You're talking about Freak of the Week, and it does have those episodes where this is the reason I don't watch TV, is this idea that you have to build a narrative and then conclude it in an hour. I watch TV because you can build a narrative over 12 hours or 8 hours. I don't want to see something completed in 60 minutes. It's just rushed and it doesn't work for me. I think a lot of TV that does work now has a sense of moving towards something outside of its episodic structure. It's moving towards something with an end goal, not just continuously developing without an end in sight. I mean, for the briefest of moments watching Lost, I thought it had an end goal. And then, as we all know, yeah, I was a fool for thinking that. Yeah,
it's nice to be an optimist, but
yes, I know. I'm angry at that show. I can't ever think about rewatching it because I think it just wouldn't watch and recurring. But something like, I suppose what I'm saying is, I want every TV show to be a mini series at least, and it has an end goal. It has an end it's reaching for. I'm watching Breaking Bad just now, and like, you know, I never felt that show was just going nowhere. It was always leading to what's coming. I don't even want to talk about it too much because I'll end up talking for hours. There was always going to come up to what's going to, the situation it's in right now is always going to get there, down to those two characters. And that's why I'm happy with where a lot of genre TV is. And I'm probably going to keep seeking it out, but I'm going to use my wife as a tastemaker because I hate TV for the most part. I mean, Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, and a handful of others, but I'm not a big advocate of it. I'm probably just saying the exact same thing you're saying, Nick, but in different ways. I love it, but I don't really like it.
Yeah.
You know, where I'm really looking forward to Game of Thrones season 4, but I'm terrified that Game of Thrones won't pan out as a TV show because the books aren't even finished. And I'm terrified that I feel the same way about Game of Thrones in a few years, that I'm a little bit lost now, but it just didn't pan out. I'm really scared.
Yeah, they might reach a kind of awkward point when they have to kind of, you know,
ad-lib.
Overwrite, you know, for, you know,
yeah,
a year or so. Like, this is what we made.
Yeah.
So and I could happen. I mean, it's all, things are, you know, diverging in areas from the book, you know. You know, since, you know, basically since the second season started. So, you know, there are characters that are missing and characters that have been kind of, you know, rolled into one for the TV show and that kind of thing. So there are, like, you know, alterations that are made, and, you know, I think they've done them very ably,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, it'd be, you know, an interesting point where, you know, they might get to, okay, you've not finished the book yet, but can you tell us what's going to be in it?
Yeah, it's just, that seems like a really weird situation. I mean, thankfully, as a George R. R. Martin, is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a TV writer beforehand, so I think he'll have every sympathy for, you know, what they need to achieve in the course of the TV show. And from what I can see, just I haven't read about it in depth, but he's quite proud of what people have made of his work, and he's, you know, I don't think he's looking to make sure it's anything but a success. So I think he'll be completely cooperative. He's probably already had a lot of really detailed discussions about how it's going to end. Well, that's assuming he knows how it's going to end. I don't even know. I haven't read the books. I'm holding off on that.
Yeah, I mean, the more you read the books, the less faith you have that it's like, you know, it's coming to a neat conclusion, because, you know, it keeps growing and mushrooming and, you know, okay, yeah, I know we're supposed to be at the penultimate kind of stage of this story, but here's another, like, gigantically significant character whose arc we're going to start right now and see what happens with that. And you're just like, really? Oh, okay.
Emma's okay, just started watching. She's just started watching Game of Thrones with her mother, her sweet little Irish mother, and are sitting down.
That'll be comfortable. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think her mum's quite into it. I don't think Emma's managed to stick with it. I think her mum's on disc 4 or something of the first season, but Emma's only watched the first episode with her.
I'm looking forward to it. Like, my brother-in-law hasn't seen it. Mostly because he's got like a 3 and a 4-year-old girl and has to watch television with them, but he's gotten to the point where they're disciplined to go to bed now and they watch TV together. So I'm going to buy him the box set for his Christmas so he can enjoy the sex violence and nudity as Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I think we're waiting till we move in and we don't have any money to like spend on anything, and then Emma's going to use her Netflix 1 month free trial or whatever and see if we can burn through. I think Boardwalk Empire's on it.
It's HBO. Not. Breaking Bad's on there.
Breaking Bad is, yeah, I think that's...
You won't regret time spent on that. That's a... You're talking about shows starting off, like, a certain tone. Well, I don't know, I'm thinking about it. Breaking Bad starts off as, like, a black comedy and then quickly becomes not a black comedy, just dark. But anyway, once again, honestly, if once you watch Breaking Bad, let's talk about that at length, because I don't want to go off on that, going to be a very long time. Let's talk about this week's feature. We're working through our list of shames, lists compiled of films that we haven't seen. So for example, my list was compiled by Martin and Nick. The films they felt I should have seen from the IMDb top 250. A film which neither Martin or Nick had seen was Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, and this kind of shocked me. Not that I'm the biggest advocate of the movie. I'd say I'm a fan, but I'm not one who would put it in my top 5. But just that it is such a lauded film, and it's essentially considered by a group of people the greatest film ever made, and for them there's the only real competitor to that is Citizen Kane. And the fact that neither of you have seen it kind of just took me back one, that you didn't have an opinion on, you know, what is considered to be like the greatest work of art that cinema's ever produced. Have you just avoided it, or you just didn't care?
it wasn't like a purposeful, you know, act of avoidance. It was just I hadn't got around to it.
It was never on the telly, or
plenty of times. I mean, my mum's a big Alfred Hitchcock fan. I mean, I think North by Northwest is probably her favourite film. It's, well, maybe Die Hard, but you know,
that's the one she says. Is that right? Yeah,
probably Die Hard. But no, it just it hadn't really occurred to me to seek it out. It's just like you say, it's a gap that, you know, that should have been covered that wasn't. You know? And I mean, I can understand why it's been, you know, so highly lauded and has done really well in the kind of, you know, approval by committee that is required to have something, you know, get to the sort of, you know, status of being this is the number one film in our list of all time. It's a beautiful film. Absolutely stunning to look at. External shots, internal shots, there's so much texture and nuance and communication within how it looks. I mean, I can see from that point of view, it really is, you know, approaching, you know, the kind of the peak of, you know, a visual art. I couldn't say that I loved the film. I enjoyed the film. I'd happily, like, you know, watch it, you know, again, and, you know, follow up in years to come and see, you know, what else comes from it for me. But it was, for me, a beautifully shot, you know, kind of, you know, intrigue drama with, you know, a fairly telegraphed kind of, you know, twist to justify all the plotting around this, you know, the missing person and this sort of split personality storyline, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I may be coming at it slightly differently. Like, when I was growing up, Hitchcock was, like, my hero. He was, like, when I was 12 to, like, maybe 12 to 15, Hitchcock was, like, the only thing that was, you know, on my mind at any given moment. Like,
but was it just not in the box set that you had or something?
Oh, no,
or?
I had plenty of opportunities to see it, like, and I owned it. Like, I used to, like, just right as I got into Hitchcock, there was, like, a sci-fi a season of Hitchcock films, and I had them all taped, and I made little labels for them, and I had them set up in my own little collection. But Vertigo was one I never could get into sufficiently to see it all the way through. Like, I mean, name any Hitchcock film, I'd seen them all, but and I still had this same problem when I approached it this time. It's that those first 2.5 scenes, I can't stand, and I can't get past them. In fact, I actually started watching this film a week ago, and I got to those. It was during those 2.5 scenes where I'm like, right, I'm out. Thick Mackey. Come on, The Shield. Season 4, let's go. I absolutely despise the first, like, up until the proposition is made in the office at the boatyard,
mm-hmm.
which is a moment I'd never gotten to. And if I had gotten to that moment, I would have seen the film through. But because I didn't, I absolutely loathe the opening 5 to 10 minutes of this film. And I could never get past it. So for that reason, I was quite happy to see the film through. I don't want to go on to it completely just now, but the film was kind of a surprise for me. Did you have a past experience with Vertigo, Jack?
No, it was just, I mean, I've talked to this at length. The type of person I am, I'm some sort of a completionist, and I don't think it's a very proud thing to be. I think it means you watch a lot of shite for the sake you said you've seen it. I'll admit that. But Hitchcock came up, and I'm still working on Hitchcock. I try and watch like one every 6 months, and I've fallen by the wayside and watch one once a year. But Vertigo was like the second one I watched after Psycho. So it was just like, you've seen Psycho, have you seen Vertigo? Like, no, oh, you have to see Vertigo. And even before, like, Rear Window and things like that. So it was like one of my first experiences with Hitchcock. And I was kind of surprised at the rest of his body of work in comparison to it, because it's, I don't know, I can kind of, I get people's hype with it. I mean, it's definitely not my favourite of his films, but it's the one I can talk about at length the most. It's the most subtle, it's got the most It's got the most reflective quality to it. I think it's got the most rewatchability. I've seen it maybe four or five times now, and I like and dislike different parts of it every time I see it. And I don't think that's something I can really see of any other film. I mean, I understand your discomfort with the opening two scenes. Okay, this is a background check. Vertigo goes through a really weird structure. It starts off with a man, a police officer, who suffers from extreme vertigo as a result of like a horrific accident he had during a rooftop chase in San Francisco, and he's terrified of heights. He's retiring from the police force, and then he's approached with a proposition from an old school buddy. But the two in-between sequences that you hate, Nick, I do get why you hate those. They're very awkward and stilted and strange.
Bag of shite, I think, is what you... that you're searching
well, that's
for.
That's a very nuanced description of the problems of that scene.
Yeah. Just because he feels dizzy?
I don't know. It's because there's absolutely nothing propelling them that it just is so desperate. And this will be a problem through the whole film, I think. But for those opening...
Is it the relationship?
I think it's because, like, we actually talked about this a bit with Polanski, where you get some directors who aren't really interested in... you know, developing characters. They're more interested in having characters and then just casting an analytical eye on their behaviour. So, like, they just keep at a distance and just, you know... It's almost like they're not photographing characters, they're just photographing behaviour. And whoever happens to be involved in that behaviour is, the character that Hitchcock's going to be following. It's a difficult thing to describe, but it's like a really passive camera. I think Hitchcock describes actors at one point as being like cattle... And you can kind of see that attitude through most of his films, where, like, you might as well just have, like... It almost feels like, do you ever watch, like, an animatic storyboard of something where, like, the actors aren't involved? It's just, like, almost like a CG cartoon of whatever behaviour is happening in a film. That's what the opening sequence feels like to me. That's what the second sequence feels like to me, where it just feels completely functional and completely detached from any real sense of character. That, you know, it's just like, so in the opening sequence we have a chase, and this is what the chase looks like, and this is why this character has vertigo. And in the second sequence it's like, this is the relationship between these two characters, this is the gentleman's problem, watch how he tries to overcome it and then doesn't. There's something about it that feels really impersonal and very cold, and I think Hitchcock's films always fall into that category unless they are balanced out by a suitably high concept story, or like a suitably sensational story, like,
or Cary Grant.
Yeah. And I mean, Jimmy Stewart's doing good work, you know, but I don't think Hitchcock's doing him any favours. Like, you know,
the way films the scenes really weird though. I mean, you never, I think there's one two shot of those two characters the whole time, otherwise he's being really rigid and he cuts back and forth the frame. Even the way they're framed within each shot, the two shots and cutting back and forth, you've got two people which are at the furthest ends of the frame or in the middle of the frame both times. So he's just making this huge... Like, I understand where you're coming from. This overstatement to separate them as characters, they're not a couple.
Yeah.
They're sharing a house together, they're not a couple. And it's just the cinematic language, which is a bit of an overstatement. And I think he's at pains to state that. But... honestly, I kind of dissected that scene really heavily because it was so oddly shot. So oddly shot. But you just... I wouldn't say it revolted me. It just maybe it was like, this is odd. Why is
it? I can see how
like
it creates a distance, though, because when... I mean, I think it's inevitable watching a Hitchcock film now that if you're watching it, you're like, you know, oh, wow, he's like a sort of, you know, a master, you know, scenarist and, you know, this will be, you know, placed in the foreground and the background will be really complex and it'll be very deep and people are divided and separated, and there's a technique to it, and you know, it can, you know, produce beautiful images, but it's something that, you know, creates a kind of a distance as well from actually just, you know, engaging, you know, in with the story and in with the characters and just, you know, getting to that stage where you're just going with the flow of a film rather than, you know, breaking it down into its component parts, because I think the way that, you know, the internal, you know, scenes are shot with, you know, such rigorous, you know, framing and, you know, prop placement, it makes you so conscious that, you know, you're watching something really, really, really deliberate. And, you know, that's a sort of natural thing to actually, you know, focus on, but then you're like, well, hang on, what's going on with the story? I think
deliberate's a very good word. That's a word that always comes up in my mind when I'm watching a Hitchcock film, that it is so fucking deliberate that it's exhausting by the end of the film, and it just feels completely unnatural and passionless almost.
They're very technical films until you have, like, say like North by Northwest, when it's just like, you know, such, like, you know, madcap humour and outlandish, you know, sort of, you know, peril that Cary Grant's in, that, you know, you kind of get swept up.
You're forced
into the story.
Yeah, but you can't help but get caught up in it.
But in a more kind of, you know, sedate plot, like in Vertigo, it's there to be, you know, visually dissected.
Yeah. And not only that, like, we'll probably talk later on about ways that I feel like Hitchcock is kind of cynical about the way
we won't.
Okay,
no.
Right.
No.
Okay, well then.
Well, why don't you get this off
your
chest?
Just give it two thumbs up. No.
Well, what do you mean cynical? Please go on.
Well, no, I mean, I think he's cynical about the way characters feel, and then it leads to this film ultimately collapsing in on itself. I feel like, I think the film is a success, but it's barely a success for me. And Hitchcock has plenty of opportunity to, you know, to strike this one right out of the park, but I don't think he does. It's difficult to dive straight into this, because I feel like, you know, we start the train rolling at 150 and then don't look back. But you think about the romance scenes in this film, and they are just so cynical that it's laughable at points. I believe Jimmy Stewart has his big kiss with her name's completely
Kim Novak.
That's Kim Novak.
Yeah.
I believe they have their first kiss in front of crashing waves at a beachfront. And yeah, it's laughable. It's completely preposterous. And because we don't believe in their relationship, ultimately when it comes to like a nuanced dissection of this person's emotional state in the latter half of the film, it ends up, you just think, what, that fucking melodrama from earlier? This is what's, you know, driven him to this point of insanity. And because go on.
I'm cutting you off twice in a row.
No, it's because Hitchcock considers emotion and melodrama to be the same thing, that ultimately when we're expected to get invested in this character's emotional turmoil, you end up being completely divorced from, you know, from the kind of the feelings that Hitchcock needs you to have to carry this journey through.
I would agree with a lot of that, but it wasn't something I felt in the first, second or third viewing. And I think I enjoyed everything where Jimmy Stewart's at a distance from the character and they're not interacting. And I enjoyed it because I think that Alfred Hitchcock is a pervert and likes to watch people from a distance. And I think in this film, what he's doing is he's talking about his need to control dress-up women, which he did throughout the course of his films. You talk about him filming people as if they're cattle and not actually maybe having them do certain things, and I don't think that's true of female characters. I think he pawed them very heavily and wanted them to be and look a certain way on film. His relationship with what's her name? Tippi Hedren from The Birds is kind of notorious in that she basically said, "Do not touch me, you fat pig." He was very, very controlling of all his female actresses. And I think in this film, he's maybe, obviously unintentional. I don't think he's going to be that open about how he's doing that. He's putting that into his narrative. He read this French book, this adaptation of a French novel, and felt something of himself in that. So when you get to the final scenes of the movie, just to recap the movie very quickly. In fact, you know what? No, I'm not even going to bother. It's really convoluted.
They can go and watch it themselves.
Yeah, they can go watch it themselves. But there's a scene in the film where he's modelling one woman after another. So he's modelling, he's come across this one person, and he's modelling her entirely on another woman in his life. And I think that's really, that's the part of the movie I found most interesting this watching. The first, all the scenes with Jimmy Stewart following and being a detective, I loved. And as soon as they start interacting, yeah, actually, Nekka, that's way better than I could have summarized it. He assumes melodrama and emotion are the same thing, and he doesn't. It's not very deep. It's quite shallow. It doesn't really work for me. But as soon as they get to the relationship with the second woman, you know. So I'm struggling over the fact whether I should justify my description of the second woman or not. As soon as he gets to his relationship with this second female character in the plot, I loved it. I thought it was great. I did buy the obsession. I did buy him making her up. And I thought that he completely changed the way he filmed it at that point. He filmed them in two shots together a lot. The deliberate factor of it.
Yeah, they seem they're way more a couple than the original couple.
Yeah, yeah, and it was really, really good. I completely bought it, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed those sequences way more than I did than every time I'd ever seen it before, and I felt way colder about the other sequences before. So this deliberate aspect he's got is just direct, and it came off in a literal way with me, I think, that these scenes that were before were kind of cold and sparse, and the romance wasn't really there. And
you don't think that's maybe, you know, a deliberate effort because, you know, he's just kind of, you know, the character is, you know, sort of reliving the relationships and, you know, fine, you know, it's like a kind of a superficial thing in the initial stage. But when it gets to that, you know, reliving of it and the fetishization of it, I totally, like, stumbled over that, but, well, doesn't matter. But, yeah, the way, like, you know, just wants to, like, you know, recreate the original relationship,
yeah,
you know, again,
yeah.
And, you know, oh, put on the dress that so-and-so wore and, you know, have the same haircut and, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, you're getting to a really, like, kind of a nasty bit of someone's psyche there,
yeah.
You know?
I think it's made all the more nasty because of the counterpoint to it, where you have these discussions that come up throughout the film, like two separate characters talk about the power and freedom of the past, and it's like, I mean, the way I interpreted it, from hearing you guys talk about it, the way you interpreted it, is that Jimmy Stewart is going to fall into some kind of chauvinistic, masculine-tended obsession with controlling female identity and turning them into exactly what he wants them to be. The counterpoint to that, which is explored in the film, I think, is that there's a desire to crave love, you know, even if it means being controlled. Like, you see, definitely by the end of it, Tippi Hedren, what's her name?
Kim Novak. Yeah.
Kim Novak
is I'm sure the character had a name as well, but we're not really doing
that. Her name's Madeline in the first instance.
And then Julian the second, I great. Remember that. Yeah.
Okay. Good work.
But she's definitely prepared to go with what he's saying as long as he'll give her, you know, his affection. It's the same with Midge, the character who he lives with, who is, for all intents and purposes, a progressive, forward-thinking, independent woman of, is it the 50s or 60s?
It's late 50s.
Late 50s. Even she is so craves Jimmy Stewart's approval and affection that she is driven to the point of, like, pulling her hair and, you know, thinking, what a fool am I, you know, and it's definitely a kind of a dark counterbalance that Hitchcock plays with, that there is this give and take on both sides, and both coming together in this way is destructive for either party.
What did you think this was going to... Okay, excuse me. You did enjoy it, but you weren't completely into it. Do you imagine that if you're rewatching this, you'd get more out of it? Because I promise you, based on what I've seen, I've gotten something different out of each time.
There are things that I absolutely adore about this film, like, I think are among the best things I've seen in a film for as long as I can remember. The central, like, I don't know if we agree that this is the best portion of the film, is, like, when he first gets his mission following... I'm just going to call her Kim Novak, because this is annoying me. he follows Kim Novak from, you know, whatever she's doing during the course of her day, from that point up to the end of the hotel scene, is like, I was just like in heaven during most of that. Like, that was, like, talk about visionary, that sequence. I mean, it sort of ghostly whilst in this San Francisco burning sun. It's like, it feels like Mulholland Drive, actually, in the 1950s.
Yeah.
The way he walks around these, you know, perfectly creepily, you know, structured shots. And, you know, you've got this weird sun-kissed glow over everything that makes it look kind of spectral and spooky. And this sort of leery, creepy camera with these broad characters that we don't know anything about besides, you know, whatever creepy agenda they're fulfilling in these moments. And it's just, like, suffocating with, you know, this intense... I mean, it's like a dark curiosity throughout every single scene. And plus, like you said, the photography and those, like, the car sequences is astonishing. Like, I couldn't believe my luck when I was watching it. I know Hitchcock likes his rear projection shots, but anything out the front of the car is just, like, incredible. Absolutely loved it.
The first time I saw that film, I had a complete review with you. Like, the first few times, I've lost how many times. I've seen it 4 times. Is that right? Whatever. The first few times I saw it, I felt that way. Rewatching it now, there's like a few central twists inside the course of the story, but the supernatural element of it, it just kind of bored me this time around, and I think it's because I'm more of a cynic, or maybe because I knew the twist. So I didn't really get behind it the first time in that. But this is what I'm talking about, and rewatching this film, I do get something different every time. Like the last section, just going over what I just said, or what really got me. The relationship and Kim Novak's performance when she's two different characters was tremendous. Amazing. Her, like, her mannerisms are just completely different.
I don't even know where we are anymore.
Girl.
Is that the right person?
Hmm?
Is Kim Novak the right person?
This is the actress, yeah.
Did I say Kim Novak?
Yeah.
Right, because I thought I was saying the wrong person when I said Kim Novak.
No, you're saying the right person, Nick. We're good.
Okay.
Right, so, the actress, Kim Novak, playing two separate characters in the course of a film, who's actually one character by the end twist. But anyway, she plays a very wholesome upper-class girl who Jimmy Stewart, you know, is investigating in the first half of the film, and she plays a really streetwise girl in the latter half that he becomes obsessed with because of her. He assumes that she's a doppelganger for this woman he's fallen in love with. I think her performance in that, I mean, you can say a lot for the way she was, like, made up, like, going back to Hitchcock's obsession with that. Her makeup and the way her hair was done, she just looked like a different person. It was shocking. The first time I saw it, I didn't think it was the same actress.
I didn't think it was the same actress.
No, I mean, that's just, like, a good, you know, that was everyone else involved in the film. That was great, you know, choices in actually making her look like a different person. But you can't underestimate the power of her performance in that. Just the way she exudes a different personality. It's just, that's fantastic. She's so good at that. That's all my favourite part of the film, is her performance in that section and her relationship with Jimmy Stewart's character.
Yeah, and that's pretty interesting to me, like, the fact that I could watch it again and pick something up that, you know, that maybe wasn't as important to me this time. Because it seems like you were on the same course as me, Jack, like, the first time you watched the film to where you are just now. So maybe by the fourth time I watch it, I'll get more out of the sections that didn't really do much for me.
The first time I saw the melodrama, it didn't bother me at all. I remember just thinking it was like, I wasn't enamoured with the romance, but I thought it was good. And then as time goes on, that's probably the most critical part of it. And then watching it this time around is like, well, maybe that's intentional. Maybe Hitchcock wants me to feel this way about this romance. So Martin Scorsese was talking about this recently. He gave this big speech, I think it was in the New York Society of the Arts, and he's talking about, you know, his private passion is film preservation, and he's got this whole story about how we nearly lost Vertigo because it wasn't a huge hit. I mean, it was successful. It did, like, you know, Hitchcock did like a film a year every 2 years, released, you know, moderate fanfare. Hitchcock's a very good, skillful director. And then we almost lost it. It was out of circulation, and the only copy you could get was like a really bad, discolorized copy. And we pulled it back from the brink and saved it. But that's besides the point. His speech, he talks about his joy of Vertigo, and it's a film you really haven't seen until you've seen it twice. And that really does have undertones of kind of elitism to it. I'll admit that. But hey, that's what I'm all about. sorry, I had to get that kind of self-deprecation in there. I'd agree with him. It's a film that gives me something different every time I see it. But I'll be very upfront, and it's not my favourite film. I mean, I never make a date to see it. You know, it's just when it does come round, it's like, well, yeah, sure. I mean, my opinions on this film are constantly evolving. I've got something more to say about it every time I see it. And I think that's, you know, that's rare. You don't get many films that'll do that for you. And I think it's something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I'd you know, kind of chime in the same tone that, you know, I think it, you know, it interested me enough to merit, you know, a rewatch in a, you know, a couple of months' time, and then, you know, leave it for a year and go back and that kind of thing. No, it's you know, it's definitely a deeply interesting film, you know, but, you know, my first encounter with it wasn't, you know, oh, this is amazing. It's just, yeah, like, it's clever, you know.
It's very clever, yeah, and it's got something to it. I think most films that have that rewatchability are have an element to the cryptic or the surreal to them.
Yeah, I think for me, it's just the most interesting part was, you know, basically before the big kind of reveal that, you know, his initial love wasn't dead. I think is that, you know, Jimmy Stewart, Kim Novak, you know, acting out this really creepy relationship where they both know that it's not quite right, but it's good enough, and they'll settle for it, and it kind of gives them enough of what they want to be worth all the weirdness.
Mm.
That's great. That's so weird.
They'll sit and eat dinner together without talking, and like drive about without they're just acknowledging each other. Bizarre.
It's enough for them to be, like, you know, seen out doing that, and that, you know, people could look at them and think that's a couple going out for dinner.
Yeah,
like, just it's like they're, you know, just, they're like just they're simulating life. But, you know, that's cool.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. But, I mean, you have all these, like, here's what I'm getting at. You have all these positive things to say about the film, but if you're giving it, like, a solid star rating, well, I don't know, hang on a second, wait. My Letterboxd rating, I gave it a 3 out of 5 this time.
That's bizarre to me, based on what you've said.
I know, but I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of point I was getting at when, I mean, you... I kind of feel that you're kind of caught up a little bit in the accolades that it has, and this, like, approval by, you know, committee that, you know, we've all decided that this is very good, so there's got to be something to it, and we're all clearly, you know, have a lot of things that are, you know, we're interested in. Sorry, my wife's just creeping about on the noisiest, squeakiest floorboard in the entire house.
Do you want anything?
I'm not very hungry just now, but I'm going to have to stop and go to the bathroom soon.
That's good to know. So I'm going to go to the co-op, get some salad.
Oh, right, you're going out?
Yeah, that's what
I didn't realise. I thought you were just going to, like, go and, you know, cook something.
No, I was just going to cook something.
I don't know, I haven't really planned a meal, so...
Well, that's why I was going to buy a bag of nuts from the co-op, so I can tide myself over to making steaks, or you can eat whatever.
Well, we have food that I can eat in the house, so that's fine. Okay, I'm cool.
I need lettuce.
Let's
bulk up a meal.
Okay. I'm going to take the opportunity to eat another one of these biscuits, because I'm hungry.
That's fine.
Have a biscuit.
What were we talking about?
We were talking about Martin's. I was talking about the fact that, even though I had all to say about it, I gave it 3 out of 5.
Yeah.
And Martin has something valid to say at that point, so I'll let him finish his biscuit and he can have his thing to say.
Oh no, I believe I can finish it. I think he just called you a fucking idiot for following the crowd. Is
yeah,
probably the gist of it.
Yeah, you're a dreadful, dreadful sheep. And
that about right? Is that
pretty much?
Well,
yeah.
Well, how am I a sheep? For giving it 3 out of 5, I mean, I'm not following the crowd. I just think there's something to say about it, but it's not something I enjoy at every scene, at every time. It's something that I get something different out of every time I see it. But I think that's why people like it, is that it reveals something on reviewing it where your opinions could change. I don't think it's the type of film as like, I saw it again and I loved it just as much as the first time, if not more. I think it's something that your opinions change on. Because it's got so many different sections and such a weird structure, I think your opinions change on it every time you see it.
I can totally see that, yeah. I hadn't thought about how it would hold up in rewatch, but I can really see how it would improve and like you'd find new things to like about it every single time. The fact that it left me a little bit, you know, cold this time doesn't mean that it would necessarily next time. But you know,
I think it's an interesting thing when you come to like, you know, sort of recommend films that, you know, your recommendation can be based on, well, a lot of other people like it, and it's quite interesting. And I think it's quite good, but I have lots of reservations, so you gotta watch it anyway.
Yeah.
Well, don't you have films like that in your catalogue where you, okay, here's the thing, and I found this is true when you're talking to any serious, you come across someone and you get into that sort of awkward discussion about films, and then you realise that this person's actually like a huge cinephile. And I had this at work recently, and we started talking about, you know, Dutch cinema and French cinema, and I was like, oh, well, this guy actually knows his stuff. And then we both were clearly excited to talk about cinema with one another and wanted to test one another's, like, knowledge and limits. And I swear this happens every time in a similar situation. One of the two bring up Irreversible. One of the two of you will bring up Irreversible to see how far your taste will go in terms of art and nastiness. And that's one of those things you watch with absolute reservation, and you recommend very cautiously, unless you're a cinephile, and then you know you can appreciate something about it more than the sense of pure joy. You know, doesn't have a car chase. You know, the sex scenes are not what you expect from normal sex scenes. But I mean, Vertigo is, I suppose, it's not quite the same, but it's something I can recommend with reservations. It's not something I would recommend for everyone, but I think anyone who's into cinema will get something out of it. And more than that, I think people who are into cinema will get something out of it on rewatches. I'm not going to give it the highest rating or put it in the top of my list just because of that, but I think it's interesting. I think it's something that is worthy of discussion, and I think that's why it's top of these committee lists. It's because it has something for most people into cinema, and it that offers something more rewatching.
I can see that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty good summation of it. Oh, sorry, I got interference. But yeah, no, I think that's a good summation of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anyone get anything else that they're, you know, desperate to get off their chest about Vertigo?
Rudest judge in the history of cinema.
I like the cars.
Yeah.
The cars are good.
Yeah.
It's nice seeing San Francisco in film. It's like a city of visitors.
It looks so amazing in this film. Like, and the music is astonishing. With
Herman's,
those strings, that really sad string music where they're driving about these. I mean, is San Francisco a desert? Or is it? I mean, because you've got the desert, you've got the mountains, the sand, and you've got this, you know, great
coastal
forest,
so it's quite varied, isn't it?
Yeah, it's called the South Bay, even though it's north of like the San Pedro Bay, which is further south. But anyway, it's quite a diverse climate. It gets quite cold, but it's got the redwoods with reasonably close distance. I still find it absurd that they drive there on a date on a car that slow. That seems weird.
Yeah,
like it seems out of place. And if you're talking about films that feel parts of the film that feel unnatural, the part where she just jumps into the San Francisco Bay and is just sort of floating there helpless with her arms out.
Yeah.
And then Jimmy Stewart jumps in and you realise like she just jumped like 6 feet. It's not like she's been knocked unconscious.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. She at that point she'd be like going, shit, call. That's just she'd be doing that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, and it's kinda that just seemed like a scene which is like, this is stupid, this doesn't really work. But yeah, I like this one of those cities I like to really see on film, probably more so than New York. Is not as much as Glasgow. Love seeing Glasgow on film every time.
Well, Glasgow subs for San Francisco and like the odd low budget feature. So.
It does, yeah. Also,
yeah, actually, like, yeah, in Cloud Atlas as well.
Yeah,
I was watching Cloud Atlas recently, and it was.
Is it good?
Yeah, I liked it quite a bit. Very ambitious, so it's obviously. Let's get scenes that succeed more than others, but definitely worth catching.
It's on my to-do list, very much on my to-do list. I haven't seen it yet, but I intend to.
The scenes shot in Glasgow look awesome.
I'm not inventing any more to-do lists for a while. They just make me feel bad about myself.
Well, you do have a child, which will slow you down some. Actually,
he did he watched most of Ben-Hur with me.
Wow.
Oh, you're letting him watch TV now?
Not watching TV, no. He's seen like 5 minutes of maybe like... he saw like a story on the news about pandas. He saw the end of Watership Down, which he completely ignored. He watched, I think, a 5 minute programme that was actually meant for kids because we were up at like, you know, the butt crack of dawn and it was just like, we need some help here. Just give us a minute. And yeah, he watched like a good solid, like, you know, couple hours of Ben-Hur with me sitting, you know, on the couch and just, you know, he had books and stuff around and, you know, a couple of toys to, you know, distract him. But whenever it was, you know, anything involving, you know, trumpets or horses or, you know, something very dramatic, you know, then, you know, he was quite into it. As soon as people start talking to each other, he's just like, I'm done, I'm out.
He likes production design?
Yeah, he was very, very keen on all the, you know, the robes and the, you know, all that kind of thing, and
they
the chariots,
natty.
You know.
I have to commend you in getting to the age he is, and only now just getting into the point of, for God's sakes, give me peace and watch the telly. Like, I give you complete respect for that, because that comes like most parents and like,
I don't think many kids have Ben-Hur as their first movie. He's going to be a little off.
Look at the nice horses.
Yeah, look at the nice horses. Just make hamburger out of Marcellus. Or Masala, sorry.
Yeah.
Not Marcellus Wallace, no. That'd be some chariot race.
It really would be.
Charlton Heston against Bing Rains.
Imagine the horse just like, fuck, you know, Rains, taking a pass.
Oh god, I'm going to feel this tomorrow. It's a hard life being a chariot horse.
Are we done with Vertigo?
I think we're done with Vertigo. Okay, well, thank you for listening to Film Interrupted. Until next time.
Cheers, it's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Film Interrupted. If you want to contact us, we can be reached at Film Interrupted on Gmail, Tumblr, Facebook, and of course iTunes. If you'd like to contact us on Letterboxd, I can be found under TechnoSnob303, Martin under Martino Heat, and Nick under Nick Edie. Nice handle, Nick.